Yet looking around the exquisite forest, I wondered, how could I possibly give this up? It was clear to me that planetary well-being required both saving rainforest and helping people. And work was needed intensely on both fronts. I was also beginning to think, thanks to the local staff, that these two problems were connected. Todd's story about logging to pay for a hospital visit suggested that to save rainforest, you might have to provide people with affordable health care. Perhaps the best way to save orangutans would actually be to save people.
Welcome to Dialogues. I'm Gary Aslanian. This is a special series of the Global Health Matters podcast. In this series, I'll be blowing open some of the echo chambers that exist in global health. To help me in this quest, I've invited thoughtful and inquisitive individuals from different walks of life. Each of them has explored and written about global health issues from different disciplinary perspectives. I hope this dialogue series will give you, the listeners, an opportunity and space to step out of your daily routine and contemplate global health issues through a different lens. So let's get started. For our final Dialogues episode of Season 3, I'm joined by Kinnery Webb. Kinnery is an American medical doctor, public health innovator, and a thought leader on the interconnectedness of planetary and human health. Kinnery's journey started at the age of 21, working as a research student at the rainforests of West Kalimantan in Indonesia. Years later, she combined her experiences gained in the rainforests with her skills as a health provider and established a nonprofit organization called Health in Harmony. In her book, Guardians of the Trees, Kinnery shares her personal and professional stories and the process that enabled her and her team to develop a novel model that provides healthcare as an incentive to protect the environment. Hi, Kinnery, how are you today?
I'm good. It's lovely to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Kinnery, throughout your career, you have spent many hours, months, and years in the rainforests of Indonesia. Do you remember what surprised you most in your initial visits?
Yep. You know, we talk about the rainforest being incredibly biodiverse. But what we don't realize, or I didn't realize until I was deep in the forest, was what that really means. Everything is rare. If you sit around with a group of scientists who've spent many years in the forest and local community members who've, you know, many years, they will all tell you some incredible story that no one else in the group has ever heard of or seen or known of, you know, like... Mm-hmm. Everything is incredibly rare and precious and amazing. One time I saw this thing in the forest, a little bush that was entirely covered with iridescent beetles, all different colors, yellow, pink, blue, green. I mean, wow.
One of your earliest realizations after spending time in the rainforest was also that planetary well-being and human health are interconnected issues. The one can't really be achieved without the other. In global health, there are so many silos. What helped you to connect and transcend the silos in your work?
The big thing for me was going to Indonesia, spending all this time in the rainforest, hearing the chainsaws in the distance, and being so angry at the local community members. What is wrong with these people? Don't they know that this forest is important for their own health and well-being? And then talking to them, hearing their stories. Did they know that? Absolutely, they knew that. They knew that better than I could ever know it. But what do you do if you have to choose between your short-term well-being and your long-term well-being? And when people told me that they had to log to pay for healthcare, and I'm not talking like even not only like huge, you know, say a surgery or a C-section or something like that, but even just access to something like birth control, because transportation could take like 5 hours just to get to the nearest facility that was providing healthcare. And that was really intensely shocking for me. And it changed my whole perspective on my life and on what was happening on our planet, really. So in the rainforest where I studied orangutans, I had this incredible privilege to spend an entire year there when I was 21. Some of those trees can be 22 stories tall. Some of the tallest trees in the world. Mm. And when they fall, it is like a little earthquake. You know, it shakes everything. And you can hear it from so far away, right? So this is not like oh, I'm going to go in and cut down a little small tree. This is like giant chainsaw blades, huge trees. And those trees eventually are worth tons of money on the international market. But the person who cuts them down may get tens to a few hundred dollars. So it's just a terrible lose-lose. And also the place I was working was a national park, right? People are logging inside a national park. Okay. That they love and that they want to be there for the future, but that they simply don't often have a choice. And I just felt like I couldn't go forward in the world knowing that we were losing planetary health because people needed their own health. And of course they did, right? I had to have pretty extensive healthcare a few years ago. I was grateful to be able to get it, right? But if I'd had to log to be able to get access to healthcare, even though I love the forest, I might have done it. Mm-hmm.
I was interested in reading about your experience providing medical care as part of the 2004 tsunami disaster response in Indonesia.
Yeah.
This actually brought some memories for me when I was called in the middle of Christmas holidays and to accompany a plane full of emergency supplies and medicines to Sri Lanka. And you write about how this experience for you was a blunt encounter with the shortcomings of international aid efforts, especially the lack of collaboration that often exists with local leaders and communities. I think I can relate to that. I've seen that. Yeah. How did this experience influence your future work in Indonesia?
I spent time during residency, so I sort of saw that this interconnection, I saw how much local communities really needed access to healthcare and that that was important for protecting the rainforest. And I was looking at a lot of these NGOs and thinking maybe I could get a job with one of them. But when I was there in Aceh after the tsunami, I was horrified. Local community members were saying things like, thank you for what you're providing, but like, really, what we need more than anything, we know you've received so many, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars from around the world to help us. What we really need is to clear our rice fields so that we can plant rice. And in 3 months, we will have food again, because the rice fields had all had all this debris dumped on them from the tsunami. And the local NGOs just said, I mean, I remember the sort of shock when this was announced in one of the meetings, right, the coordination meetings. And they were like, well, that's not in our brief. We don't clear rice fields. We give rice. And I just thought, what are we doing, right? Like, there's this aid has been, you know, all this money, the support has been given to these communities, and yet we are doing it in a way that is almost about perpetuating poverty. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Poverty, Inc., but this does a beautiful job of kind of describing this process. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, I cannot be part of this process.
Interesting.
And I came home totally frustrated, and I spoke to a friend of mine, and she said, well, we could start another nonprofit. We could start one that's based on the principle of listening to communities. You know, and that real shock that I had had about completely misunderstanding the situation of what was going on with the illegal logging in this national park where I had studied orangutans, where I was really blaming people or thinking they didn't understand, but that was not what was going on. They fully understood. They just didn't have a choice, right? So that key principle for me of listening to communities was really essential. So that's what we did, and we founded Health and Harmony.
Mm-hmm. And of course, after the tsunami, you completed your residency training outside of San Francisco and then returned to Indonesia to start that initiative.
Yes.
And I found it very interesting how you were able to address a healthcare challenge and an environmental challenge at the same time. How did you discover that interconnectedness? Tell me more.
So again, that experience of feeling like I didn't understand things really drove me to just listen to community members. So when we started, we did 400 hours of listening to all of the communities all the way around the national park. I should say too, actually, that I didn't know that I was going to start around Gunung Palung National Park, which is the place where I'd studied orangutans. I spent a year traveling around Indonesia first. And what I discovered was that the situation was the same everywhere I went. And now we know that it's a situation is the same in many places all over the world. Without access to basic services, their basic needs, communities are often driven to destroy their local ecosystem, even when they really don't want to do that. And so, so we just listened. And I thought every community was going to come to a different solution, and they did not. Every single community came to the same consensus independently about what the key solutions would be for them. And the way that we phrased the question was this. We said, you all are guardians of precious rainforest that is valuable to the whole world and that helps support the health of the whole world. What would you all need as a thank you from the world so that you can thrive and the forest can thrive? And what people said was they needed healthcare access. Sure enough, that came out straight. Without that, we cannot protect the forest. We cannot thrive, right? And we need organic farming training. And they also wanted help with education for their kids. And it's interesting because everywhere we've been in the world now, those three things keep coming out as really critical.
That's a very interesting realization. And actually, in our next season, we're interested in doing an episode on holistic health, but it's not been that easy to find examples where this has happened in practice. Yeah. And this was interesting for me to learn about the program, which was founded on a desire to deliver truly holistic health to rainforest communities. Maybe let's listen to another extract from your book.
I told her about my vision for this work. I explained how, as doctors, we were taught to see people as just assembled body parts. In her case, as a dentist, the teeth, and not holistically. I told her about people having to log to pay for medical care and how the health of the environment affected human health. I believed we should not only be treating people as whole human beings, but also expand the circle out and treat the community and the environment. I didn't agree with just putting band-aids on people's medical problems. I thought we should be treating the causes of the medical problems as well.
Kinnari, can you explain in a nutshell how you were able to create a holistic intersectional model capable of caring for people and the forest?
Well, again, I would say I didn't do it. The communities did it, right? They designed these intersectional solutions, which often I didn't even understand the full extent of how these things were intertwined until many, many, many years later. And I think it's so critical to really recognize that the people who are closest to a problem understand those problems in their fullest complexity, and they understand the key solutions. And it's also more than that too, because when they are asked what the solutions are, and then those are implemented, it's a very different feeling. It's one of empowerment. It's one of excitement. It's one of like, wow, we were listened to. Everything is now beginning to change in our community. It's really working. So that, I think, is also a really important component of it. It's a somewhat anti-colonial approach, right? Much of the aid world is extremely colonial, and it's racist, and it's, you know, elitist, and it's educationalist, I might call, you know, like this idea that those who are the experts, the quote unquote, like I have a medical degree, therefore I know what should happen. No, the local communities are really are the experts and one should listen to them. I said those three solutions that the communities wanted. They wanted healthcare access, they wanted organic farming training, and they wanted education access. And that's for adults and kids, actually. And in all three of those, they're all overlapping, right? And they're all interconnected. And we made that very obvious in a lot of different ways, designed by the communities. So it's things like communities got extra discounts if they were protecting the forest in their healthcare, right? Because they were protecting the health of the whole community. They were protecting the health of the whole world. And therefore, it made sense to give them more gratitude from the world. The communities also designed this because they loved the fact that they could get the few cheaters to stop. Because if the whole community was getting benefits and there was sort of pressure on anyone who was not working towards the health of the whole, to work towards, you know, to switch that around. So it's the classic problem of the tragedy of the commons, right? And then the other thing is that we wanted to make sure everyone could always access care, even, you know, even if they were in a heavily logging community, et cetera, or if they didn't have money. So people can pay with non-cash payment options, including seedlings or other handicrafts, things like that, or they could also pay with labor. So in those ways, it just works more towards the holistic everything all working together.
Many of our listeners are also health professionals. What kind of advice would you give to them how to be better prepared to deliver this kind of holistic care like you've done?
Saqib Bursa, who is he's our medical director, and he came to us from Doctors Without Borders. He's just a remarkable, incredible physician. And, you know, he talks about his experience at Doctors Without Borders, where if you had someone, you know, kids who came in with malnutrition, well, you treat them with Bumpy Nut, right? In a little plastic container. And that was probably, you know, those peanuts are probably grown in the United States or in Brazil, somewhere like that, and flown all over the world. Like, we're not treating the underlying cause, which is not to say if a child is malnourished, we do not want to treat them. We obviously do, right? But at Health and Harmony, we're not only treating the acute malnutrition, but then we're talking to the community about why is there hunger, right? What are the solutions so that you all are thriving? And they are designed, like in Madagascar, designing these very comprehensive food systems that they just needed access to a little bit of education or certain kinds of seeds or, you know, a little bit of help with irrigation systems, things like that. And suddenly they go from one crop of rice a year to three. And for Saqib to see that and to see, wow, like this is a totally different way of addressing the problem. And that's, I mean, that's just the little sort of human malnutrition part I'm addressing, right? Like we are thinking as well about ecosystems and whole community thriving and then whole global thriving. And it's interesting because Doctors Without Borders is coming to us and saying, hey, we need to rethink the way we're doing this. And I would say we all need to rethink. Climate change is the greatest threat to human health there is. And if we are addressing human health without even thinking about that, we are missing the picture.
And it is impossible, yeah.
And we can do it all, right? We can do, and it's not like there's something we have to like trade off and lose. No, it's win, win, win. Hmm.
You already mentioned the importance of listening to communities, and I'm curious, how did this ongoing listening process enhances the agency and ownership of communities, of their health?
Yeah, I'll tell you a story from Madagascar. Women who, when we first started there, did not even usually participate in meetings. Women are now calling meetings to tell, you know, our team there in Madagascar, like, oh my goodness, look at how healthy we are. Look at how well things are going. We're not afraid of the hunger season. Our kids are in school, you know, and now we got to deal with this little, you know, this problem with the charcoal production. And we got to figure out how to, you know, like they are the agency and the, it's stunning to me to see that. And the pride like, we have never worked with a nonprofit community member saying this, right? We have never worked with a nonprofit that actually listened to us. You implemented the solutions we said, and now look, we were so right, right? To see like, and all these other nonprofits that came in and nothing changed. So that feeling of we do know the solutions, we can bring about dramatic change is really important. And I'll give you another example from Indonesia. One of the community members, one of the community leaders there is saying, we are the pathfinders for where the world needs to go, for how to live in balance with the earth and with humans, right? And he says, we want to now teach the world.
Okay.
That's important. Like, that's a huge difference. And I'll just add one thing here. The argument I often hear against this is, well, theoretically, there might be a better solution than the communities know. How could they possibly know about all the solutions, right? And maybe that's true, that in theory, there might be some, like, better solution. But in reality, there isn't, because these community members are ready to implement that solution. And that means that they will really do it. And you could come in with some new idea, but they are not going to do it because they don't believe in it, right? It would take you so long to even convince them to do that.
And so, by the time you do it, it will be a whole other world and a whole other issues.
That's right. And then you don't have the empowerment to.
Let's switch gears a bit and speak a little bit more about your personal journey, which is really woven throughout your book. And despite a deeply satisfying career, you described the demands and pressures and stresses that work in global health placed on you. I'm sure many of our listeners would be able to identify with this. How have you found hope along your journey, and what changes did you have to make to find that fulfillment?
So the hope, I would say, has been from just watching change happen so dramatically. You know, in our first site, after 10 years, we had a 90% drop in logging household. We had a stabilization of the loss of the primary forest, and 52,000 acres of rainforest grew back, right? Like, just 67% drop in infant mortality. But not all those are numbers, but like actually looking at the dramatic change in the communities and to see their excitement, that all of that brought me great hope. And now we're doing it in Brazil and Madagascar, and we're seeing it work in all these different places. That also is very exciting to me. And it's terrifying too, right? Like, we are facing the end of civilization. If we don't really realize that, even if we stopped 100% of all fossil fuel emissions and we continued to lose rainforest at the rate that we are losing it, it would still be game over. Rainforests are absolute, they are the heart and the lungs of the world. Like, we really need to think about that in that way. We can amputate an arm and still survive. Not well, but we can survive, right? But without the heart and lungs, we won't make it. And so I really think about our planetary ecosystem, right? As it's only 2% of the surface of the Earth, but that 2% has 50% of the world's species. It cycles water all over the Earth, and it contains so much carbon. Like, just Indonesia has 9 times global emissions stored in the forest, right? So if we lost that through fire or these tipping points, which can happen, right? Because if you lose the forest, too much of the forest doesn't create rain for the rest of the forest. And then it tips to savanna. So how do I maintain hope? One of the things I have learned slowly over my lifetime, and I will say it has been slow, is that personal thriving is community thriving, is global thriving. Like, they all go together. I really learned this after I was stung by a box jellyfish and I spent almost 2 years in bed. We have to take care of ourselves as well. And that when we are thriving, then we can really truly support community thriving. And when a community is thriving, it can support global thriving.
Some of what you're saying really highlights the bit of a tension between having clear calling for global health justice and going forth with steady dedication, simultaneously the need to let go and not hold things too tightly and listen to the world around you. If you were to compare yourself now to that 21-year-old of you who first arrived in the rainforest, what has changed in how you approach your work now?
So I think I always did this, but I'm doing it a lot more now, which is that I would say stepping back, actually, and supporting others. And really, like, I'll give you an example. So Monica Nirmala, she came to work at our program in Kalimantan as a dentist. And then I was stung by the box jellyfish. Suddenly, I couldn't help run the program anymore. And I think she was 23 at the time. We promoted her to be the executive director, which was kind of crazy, but she was so brilliant and so good at doing all this stuff. And I just truly believed in her. And she ran the program for 6 years, and my goodness, she was great at it. And then I sat down with her and I said, what is your vision for your future? What do you want to do? And she said, I really want to do a master's in public health. And I thought, I just like, it just like my belly just sunk, like, oh my goodness, how can we survive without her? But I knew, and this is the big thing I have been like promoting all the time. What is your magic wand? What is each person's magic wand? Where would you thrive the most? Where is your overlap with what the world needs? And so I was like, okay, we just have to trust and believe this. And I helped her. And she ended up going to Harvard and did a master's in public health at Harvard. And then she went back to Indonesia and she's now number two at the Ministry of Health. And she was instrumental in how well Indonesia did in managing the pandemic, which was brilliantly done. And she is now working on shifting the Ministry of Health to really think about planetary health, to think about prevention of pandemics, not just, you know, dealing with a pandemic once it occurs, to think about integrating the health of ecosystems with the health of humans. I just feel like my job is to help support others and to really help kind of everyone I encounter think about what is your piece of the puzzle? How can you thrive personally? How can your community thrive? How can the world thrive through what it is that you do?
Maybe as a final question and reflecting on our conversation and what you've learned in the past two decades of working in enabling planetary and human health simultaneously, what are the key lessons that could help advance other public health programs globally that we want to live with them?
The first one I'll say is radical listening, right? Like this concept that those who are closest to a problem understand the problem in its fullest depth and know the solutions best. So I think that is a key part. The other one I would say is reciprocity. These are all indigenous concepts, right? I sort of came to them independently, but this is what communities, all the indigenous communities that we have worked with and many around the world, which kind of tells me these are key principles, right? If humans all over the world have independently come to them, this is important. Reciprocity, this idea that we all have something to give and that it's about an equal loving respect and gift giving mutually around the world. It's not about charity. It's not about colonial, yuckiness. And I would expand that reciprocity not just to humans, between humans, but also with the natural world, which is how Indigenous people see it as well.
Thank you, Kinnari, for this great dialogue we had. I wish you all the best for keeping up the work that you're doing. Again, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kinnery's story is one of courage. She boldly set out to question and counter the traditional ways in which public health is delivered by building bridges across issues and silos. Kinnery's work highlights the importance of two values, generosity and gratitude. Through intentional listening and including Indonesian communities, she and her team were able to effectively improve access to healthcare, reduce the illegal logging of trees, and alleviate poverty in a more sustainable manner. They conduct their work not on principles of charity or saverism, but rather as a gesture of gratitude and respect to communities for their role as custodians and protectors of broader collective global health. I'd like to leave you today with a final reading from Kinnery from her book, Guardians of the Trees. It may help you consider your own role in global transformation towards a thriving future.
The dream also made clear that I was not alone in this, that each of us has something to give to the solution. Every person who faces this truth has to ask themselves the same question: what is my personal role in the global transformation toward a thriving future? The science is clear. We no longer have the time to push this question off to some more convenient point in the future. We are living in the most critical period in the entire history of humankind. And if we do not act now, it will simply be too late. Did I have the courage to accept a bigger calling? Do you?
I'm very pleased with what we've done with the dialogue series and truly allowing some of you to step back and immerse yourselves in the topic and get to know our guests in a qualitatively different manner. We will be doing more of dialogues this year. To learn more about our dialogue series and the content of this episode, visit the episode webpage where you will find additional readings, show notes, and translations. Don't forget to get in touch with us via social media, email, or by sharing a voice message with your reflections of this episode.
Global Health Matters is produced by TDR, a research program based at the World Health Organization. Gary Aslanian is the host and the executive producer. Lindy Van Nicker and Obadiah George are content and technical producers. Priya Joy is the curator of the dialogue series. The podcast editing, communication, dissemination, web and social media designs are made possible through the work of Maki Kitamura, Chris Coase, Elisabetta De Si, Isabella Suder-Dayao and Chembe Collaborative. The goal of Global Health Matters is to produce a forum for sharing perspectives on key issues affecting global health. Send us your comments and suggestions by email or voice message to tdrpod@who.int and be sure to download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.